So, Michael, you were describing the reorganisation of the various commands.
Yep. Now, these reorganisations were across all the services. Same thing was happening in the Army and the Navy. They were forming different commands as well. And so it was a major change, and that, in addition to the drawdowns that I described earlier, based on the original defence review in 1990-1991, was going to cause yet more turbulence, as you can imagine. I mean, decentralising everybody out of London, forming a new command at Gloucester, putting everybody... So all of that lot was on the plate as I came into slot. Plus, and it's worth just harking back to my time at Strike Command, my major achievement there, but an achievement there, was that I won the battle against the Navy. In retrospect, I don't know if it was a good battle to win or not, but there was a reorganisation in NATO going on as well, post-Cold War, which saw the changes to the regions. If you remember, I said there was a northern, central and southern region, and UK Air. They decided to change all of that, and UK Air was to be absorbed and joined up with the northern region to become Allied Forces Northwest, leaving the central region and the southern region more or less as they were before. It was a compromise, as always. And the UK wanted to have the headquarters for Allied Forces Northwest in UK, bearing in mind we gave most of the forces for it. So the decision, the battle was between High Wycombe and Northwood, which is where the Navy. Navy wanted it there because they were having to make adjustments to their Atlantic command. They were part of SACLANT, of course. And they felt that if they had it there, it would enhance their position. And we said, well, you know, with respect, you're not even in Allied Command Europe. It's our business, and so on and so on. So we had a lively battle with a good friend of mine called Jock Slater, who was the CNC at Northwood. And I won the battle on that one. So Allied Forces Northwest was actually formed at High Wycombe using the bunker, which was by far the best bunker and had more room. I mean, it was, in terms of sheer common sense, it was the right place to put it. But nevertheless, it was a big battle because there were sort of, you know, symbols involved in having that headquarters at an RAF headquarters as opposed to a naval headquarters. So we won that one. So that was happening also when I became CAS, and the manifestation of that was going to move a lot of people around as well. So the movement of the people and dealing with all of that, plus a budget that seemed to be eternally under attack, was, I guess, the major challenge that I had when I came in.
And this seems to me, because I've been trying to seek to see why people get appointed to the jobs that they do at this level, and it really, would I be correct in saying it's your ability to be an economist. You started to have economic add an economic strength to your armoury at support command. You had to do it again at strike command, and here you are managing a budget permanently under attack. And I think from a previous conversation that we had, we have to reduce the Air Force from 89,000 people to 59,000 people.
55, yeah.
To 55,000 people, which is a massive, my mathematics isn't up to it in percentage terms, but it's 40-ish percent or something like that. That's a massive task to have to undertake.
Yeah.
And was it normal, would it, to be Chief of the Air Staff for the 5 years that you were?
No, normally you do 3 years. But I had 4.5, for reasons which we'll come on to.
Right.
I think I was fortunate to have been sent to support command, because it gave me a baptism in budgets and things like that, which was quite useful. I don't think there's any magic in it. I think, you know, the trick on all these things, to go back to something I was saying earlier, is to have an appreciation of where you're trying to get to and a sensible way of getting there, and let the details come from that. If you've got a bit of vision and you're not too reactionary, you know, some people resist change because they think it's you know, it's a backward step. And I understand that because, you know, the traditions of the services, and I think, you know, some of the regiments, for example, I can understand intrinsically why they would resist change, amalgamations and things like that, because you've seen the benefit that comes from operating as they have done over the years. The trouble is, there's no guarantee that what works in the year 2000 is what you're going to need for the year 2020. And I think you do have to have some sort of recognition that things change and that you've got to be prepared to take some risks in that process, but protect the things that really matter as the things that, you know, seem to matter.
Yes.
And in that sense, I possibly had some experience of having to take some decisions like that without feeling, oh my God, you know, I've just broke the Air Force in bits. But that came, I confronted that in Options for Change. That was the real challenge for us. As a
and
service.
When was Options for Change?
95, I think. I'm trying to remember. I'd been in 92, I started in 94, I suspect.
Still nothing.
Oh, Rifkin, absolutely. Yeah. So we were managing these changes, and along comes basically another defence review, except the Conservative government never has a defence review. It has imaginative things like Options for Change and all of that, you see. And this was dreamed up by Malcolm Rifkin, Jonathan Aitken, I think Michael Portillo was probably involved in it, almost certainly, and by the special advisor to Malcolm Rifkin, a chap called David Hart. And this man sold the view to these politicians, each one of whom was ambitious in their own way, that billions of pounds could be saved from the defence budget if you only did certain things. Civilianised masses of functions that the services currently do. Get rid of this, stop the services doing things in the Air Force and the Navy and the Army, centralise all of that. A whole bundle of changes, all of which would take some civilian management practices, which I think later I discovered, you know, were usually yesterday's civilian management practices, which serious companies had long since rejected. But nevertheless, it all looked very sexy to be able to save billions of pounds. And the proposition was put to these politicians, aided and abetted, I'm afraid, by an Air Force Air Marshal who had his own reasons for it, most of which were well-intentioned, but I'm afraid, you know, gave me a great deal of grief, that all of these things could be done, and in particular, the Royal Air Force. And this is where I come back to the earlier defence review of 1991. The Army and the Navy were quite convinced the Air Force got away with it. The reason they thought that is because we did not reduce our manpower as much as they did. Although we reduced our front line, but we didn't reduce our manpower. Now, you know, there were reasons for this. I think my predecessor might acknowledge today that his passionate defence of the numbers of blue suits was probably too strong. If we had reduced our blue suits and handed over some of the functions to the civilians at that stage, we wouldn't have been so viciously attacked in 94-95. But the moment this proposition was on the table, that billions could be saved and 2 billion of it could be saved from the Royal Air Force if only they did things differently, you couldn't imagine that the Army and the Navy would say, oh no, you couldn't possibly do that to our friends in the Air Force. They were in there, you know, loving it. So they set up this thing called Defence Cost Studies, and it was a series of 19 studies. Was it 18? I can't remember. 19. All of which was designed initially to put a group of people together to look across all the services and look at, you know, training. Could we save money in training if we all trained together or did it differently, took best practice? You know, in principle, not a bad idea. And it went right through the gamut of things. And there we were. So all this was started off. And then I remember I was taken for lunch to his home in Great North Street by Jonathan Aitken, who was by then Minister for Defence Procurement. And he said to me, you know, that he'd been told that all this money could be saved from the Royal Air Force and so on and so on. And therefore, he thought that there should be a study into the Royal Air Force as opposed to the functions. And I said, well, hang on a minute, you know, what we all agreed was that this was going to be a tri-service thing across the functions. I can't accept a study into the Royal Air Force only if there's a study into the Army and the Navy as well, which eventually they agreed. But what I hadn't appreciated at the time was that was a complete cosmetic. You know, they'd already written the conclusions for the study into the Royal Air Force, and the ones that were done into the Army and the Navy were a joke.
They being a small group of political advisors.
Well, I was then told that the study into the Royal Air Force would be done by this Air Marshal, who had already told me, you know, I mean, no secret what he wanted to do. And some of these ideas were perfectly reasonable. I had no problem with them. But the way in which he wanted to do them would have required a redundancy in the Royal Air Force of 25,000 people. 25,000 people from an Air Force that was by then 80-something. And he wanted it done in a year. I said, you've got to be joking. Can you imagine what that would mean? You would never, ever regain the trust of your people if you made 25,000 really good people redundant. It's not like, I said, this is not a bloody business. You know, business hires and fires. You can buy people off the street. They may not like it, and management is loath. These buggers move on. You know, you've got to continue to manage this lot, and by the way, you've got to make them do things like get killed. Do you think you could possibly do that when you've made 25,000 people redundant in a year with all the trauma and tragedy that would go with that? It was just crazy, crazy, silly way of doing things, plus 101 other ideas, say, of which 10% were well worth pursuing, and we were pursuing it actually anyway. I already had a study in hand which was looking to civilianise and contractorise, as it's called, large numbers of functions in the Air Force, which was being conducted by an Air Vice Marshal, and we had already set a goal ourselves of bringing the service blue suits down over a period of time to much, much less. We thought we could probably bring it down to under 60,000. And so they wanted it brought down to about 40,000 or something absolutely crazy.
So the figure of 55,000 that you eventually ended up with by the time that you left was not unadjacent to the figure which you might have been happy with anyway under your own studies.
Absolutely. I mean, ultimately I was able to say, and the agreement I reached, and I need to go back into the history of this, the agreement I reached with Rifkin on this one was that, you know, I would bring it down to a figure. He wanted it down to 53, and I got it at 55,000. I would do it over a period of time, but, you know, I had to be given the chance to do it my way, not to have it imposed on us. And eventually he agreed reluctantly that we would do that. But what you need to know in this one is that the campaign against the Royal Air Force had started about a year before, and it was being conducted
prior to 95, so in the earlier part of your CAS.
I can't remember whether it started in 94 or early. I really can't remember. Probably it was 94, wasn't it? Yes, it was. It was about January, February 94. We started to see articles in newspapers, which at the time I didn't realise quite who was doing it, but within a couple of months I did, and it was actually regurgitation of what this Air Marshal had been writing, giving it to his friend David Hart, the special advisor to Malcolm Rifkin. And it was all coming out in the newspapers about if the Royal Air Force would model itself on the Israeli Air Force, which only has 25,000 people or something, and has all these airplanes and stuff, then, you know, wouldn't it be a much better Air Force? And this was pretty poisonous stuff, actually. You know, they were really lambasting the reactionary Air Force and all of this sort of business, and it was very unpleasant. And it was also facile. Because if you wanted to say the Royal Air Force, why did you say the Army? And why do you say the Navy? Because exactly the same principles would apply. The Israelis do it, and it's very simple. As I said on the radio when I was interviewed about this, I said, if you could blow a siren in the middle of Whitehall and half the people in the offices would vanish and put on their blue uniforms and go straight to their airfaces, which are about 10 miles away, defending an area the size of Wales, then I would certainly be happy to reduce the Royal Air Force to 25,000. As you couldn't even get a siren heard in Whitehall, you know, I mean, it's just a joke. And of course the Israeli Air Force, when it actually comes up, is, you know, actually bigger than the Royal Air Force when it gets it all together. And we were operating all around the world with, you know, a whole range of roles, and it was just a facile argument. And it was unpleasant because they were setting us up for this whole thing. And that's when later that year at a lecture I let go at them in my lecture, basically saying, you know, we know what you're up to, we know why you're doing it. And that was translated very quickly as a shot at Michael Portillo and Kenneth Clark of the Treasury, because it was they who had been briefing, or indirectly. I mean, the parallels today, this is what I have found so utterly ironic, the parallels of spin and leaking and selective leaking and destroying and, you know, all of that was alive and well, thank you very much, in John Major's time, courtesy of Mr. David Hart and Messrs. Rifkin and Aitken and all of that lot, who would deny it tomorrow if they were sitting here, that they had anything to do with it. But I know bloody well they did. You know, they would, David Hart would say certain things, you know, that the Air Force could do this, that, and the other, but he didn't. They say, well, it'd be helpful if that was well known, wouldn't it? And he made sure it was well known by having lunch with the editor of the whoever. It's good stuff, you know.
And you responded with a lecture later in the year.
Yeah.
But as the newspaper articles appeared, it took you 2 months to discover the source and so on and so forth.
Mm.
How do you respond to that immediately? Presumably it's not possible for you to mount your own newspaper campaign.
No,
it wouldn't be, would it?
No, I mean, all you can do, I mean, you have two constituencies to try and deal with. You've got your own internal one, and I was as much interested in saying to my people, look, you know, don't believe this crap. They don't believe this crap, but they wanted to see somebody defending it. And equally, to say to those guys who are spinning out there, you know, we know what you're up to. I didn't win any friends in it, obviously, and I had to grovel a bit. But I think, you know, in retrospect, I shouldn't have groveled as much as I did. I apologised if they'd misinterpreted what I'd said. I probably shouldn't have apologised at all.
That was a private apology.
A lot of pressure. What?
That was a private apology to...
Well, it was on the news.
Yeah, it was on news. Yes, it was... I had to write a letter to Clark and to Portillo, saying, you know, I'm sorry if my remarks were misinterpreted. Because they'd immediately... The media had immediately assumed that I was directly criticising Portillo and Clark. Actually, I wasn't criticising Clark. I knew that Portillo's team, advised by David Hart, I mean, there was a much better story out there, actually, if the press had taken interest. And it was actually that here we had an independent advisor advising Rifkin and Portillo on a way in which, you know, Her Majesty's Armed Services could be changed with absolutely no responsibility, given access to newspapers, spinning things left, right and centre. The story ought to have been written, what the bloody hell's going on with this government? What are they up to? You know, is this the way that government should be run? But at the time, you know, it wasn't vogue. Now, just because a chap commits suicide, dare I say, it's suddenly become, you know, field day for having a go at the government. But in those days, it certainly wasn't. But that's what was going on.
Mm. Right.
Yeah. So the defence cost studies had that background to it. And, you know, we were put under the most intense pressure. The study into the Royal Air Force was the most awful study I have ever read. It was puerile. But because we were on the back foot and because we got absolutely no support from the other services on it, And because they said, well, we're having ours anyway, which was a joke. You know, I had a tough job to stop the worst of the excesses being placed on us. And at the same time, I had, I mean, it was manna from heaven, but one of my very senior commands in chief was being put to the ringer on spending too much money on his bloody curtains in the house, which was manna from heaven for Mr. David Hart and his team of spinners. That was another major article in the newspapers. I mean, trivial bloody stuff, but it was headlines in the Mail on Sunday, who ran it and hounded us all for weeks and months on end, and particularly this guy, who was a very able guy, probably had overdone it, but, you know, not the first and not the last in comparison to Mr. Derry Irving, very modest. But, you know, what a wonderful thing to hang the hierarchy on. So we were really roasted, and it was pretty disgraceful stuff.
Did you ever contemplate resignation at this time?
No, not over that issue, because I knew bloody well that if I resigned, they'd be absolutely delighted and they'd put in this other guy instead of me. And I believe that was quite the wrong thing for the Air Force. I think he would have irreparably damaged the Air Force, despite, you know, I say this now, his intentions were honourable. He was just misguided. So we fought it. And actually, I think we fought it bloody well, because the bargain that I struck on it was that if I was going to make these changes, firstly, I'd make them at the rate that I wanted them. Also, that half the things that we said we already had in hand, I mentioned the studies. So just let us do the work properly instead of just taking blunt pencils and, you know, saying you can slash it by 30,000, that was not the way to do business. And thirdly, that if I was going to do that, then I was going to get an equipment program out of it that was going to be absolutely first class. And to be fair to David Hart and to this other chap, they did want us to have good equipment. They really did. And, you know, I could understand why they said certain things, because they genuinely motivated to give us good equipment. But there's no point in having good equipment if you haven't got any people. But good equipment we wanted, and I was prepared to do that. And so we fought off the worst, and we went through all this long and very tough. I mean, it was really tough negotiations and bitter battles with ministers who were totally against us. You know, Rifkin, Aitken, in particular, all of whom were intensely ambitious men, Michael Portillo from the Treasury, all of whom had been signed up by David Hart saying, if you make a $3 billion saving, you know, you're going to get a reward, aren't you? Rifkin wanted the Foreign Office, Aitken wanted the Treasury, and Michael Portillo wanted to be a Secretary of State. He got defence. And so they got what they wanted, and arguably, you know, to hell with the armed services. But Aitken, to give him his due, we had this outrageous meeting. It really was theatre. Each of the defence studies had a little group to preside when all the recommendations had been made and they'd been put up there. The Defence Council would meet and rubber stamp it or talk it over and agree it. And the day came for the study into the three armed services, ours, which was called Defence Cost Study 19, and the Army and the Navy, which was 20 and 21, I think. I can't remember exactly, but something like that. And we started that at 2 o'clock in Chiefs of Staff room. This room was packed, absolutely packed, because everyone knew it was going to be theatre. And all the ministers were there, and the prosecution was there, and I was there. You know, there was all this bloody lot lined up. And they basically said, well, you'll go to defend the Air Force. And I said, I won't. I will bring, you know, two of my people. I had a chap called John Thompson with me, and a chap who I thought of very, very highly called John Willis, who came in with me to defend the Air Force. And for 3.5 hours, we were grilled. 3.5 hours. 5:30, we finished. I mean, it was brutal stuff. But actually, I think we won the day. And Aitken said to me afterwards, he said, by God, that was your finest hour. You know, echoing from his uncle. it's a Spitfire pilot, because we actually did hold off the worst excesses. But just to give you an indication of how barbed it was, the two other service studies were done in 3/4 an hour for the two of them. 3.5 hours we were grilled, and 3/4 an hour for the others. It was a joke, complete joke. But we won it in the sense of we resisted the worst things that were to be put upon us. And we won over the civil service in the room. I remember very well Christopher France and one or two others there listening to these arguments and eventually coming in on our side, because our logic was clear and theirs was emotional, theirs was half-baked. And when one of them stood up, David Hart, for God's sake, what the hell was he doing taking part in a meeting like this? Saying, he, as a helicopter pilot himself, he didn't think that it was necessary for this, that, and the other. I just said nothing. I just let it sit there in the air. And there was a sort of silence around the room. Everybody realised that you didn't need to say anything. But that was an indication of the sort of battles that we had then. But the upshot, of all of that was that I still had to make these reductions in the Air Force from, we'd been drawing down to perhaps 85,000 by then, down to 55,000 with a redundancy program of 12 and a bit thousand people, which we had to put in place. Now, to be fair to the Conservative government, the terms of that redundancy program, which were available for all the armed services, were actually very good. They were not immediate, which is what some of them wanted. They were over, I think, as much as a 2-year period, and volunteers could certainly be called for. It involved a tax-free bonus of, I think, 18 months' salary. So for a lot of people who might have been coming up towards retirement and things, what it meant was leaving 18 months early, and you actually got a tax-free bonus, and you could probably go off into a job anyway. So we probably got up to half of the people that we had to make redundant going not unhappily. But on the other hand, there were, some real tragedies in there. And that managing that and the implications of that from 1995 till when I went, we'd done it by the time I left. And what we had achieved then was quite the best equipment program, I think, that the Royal Air Force has ever had, which was the quid pro quo. And my task was to go around the Air Force and tell them, look, it's happened. I don't like it. You don't like it. But it has. We've got the best deal that we could get under the circumstances. And this is what the benefit's going to be. Trust me. And that was tough. That was tough to go out to people. The toughest was going into, and I went round, I took a couple of aeroplanes and flew around most of the stations over a period of about a week. And I talked to them, from the officers to the sergeants to the troops in their crew rooms, and took the flak, a lot of flak going around. But I just gave them my hope, as honest an answer as I possibly could. And if I didn't have an answer, then there was no point in doing it. But the heartbreaking thing about that was the young airmen, and we had some wonderful young airmen, terrific, who were perhaps on an 8-year engagement term, and in the normal course of events would have just been signed on for another 10 years or perhaps even 15 years and make a really decent career in the Air Force, all of whom have been scoring fantastically, fantastic young men and women, for whom there was absolutely nothing, because they weren't eligible for any terms of redundancy, they weren't eligible for any bonuses, because they would have had to sign on again. And these guys were the ones who used to come up and say, look, I'll do anything, absolutely anything. I love the Air Force. I want to stay in it. Please, what do I have to do to stay? And I hadn't got an answer to that because we didn't have room. And that was really heartbreaking. And a lot of really good people left at that time. And I think they went out, disillusioned, inevitably.
Do you think something like that leaves a permanent mark, or can a service recover from it as a new generation or half generation comes through?
I think we've recovered from it for two reasons. Firstly, the vast majority of people who were made redundant, did go out on pretty good terms and not particularly embittered. Secondly, I think we went out of our way. We formed teams, we went round everybody, you know, from the highest right the way down the command chain, to make them understand that change is not something that you can totally resist. You've got to go with it. And you've got to go with it positively rather than negatively. Make the best of it. And here's the reason why we've got some good things coming up. This is the equipment program. This is that. This is the other. Whatever. Look forward rather than backward. And I think most of them are intelligent enough to see that. And from what I